Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name is John, and this week we'll be speaking with Jonathan Ebinger, general partner at Blue Run Ventures, and what he's seeing in the world of investing and FinTech. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, let's get started. With me are my co-hosts, Monica.
Hey, John.
And Steve. Welcome.
Hey, everyone. Good to be here.
Oh, great. Yeah. And our guest this week is Jonathan Ebinger at Blue Run Ventures. Thanks for coming on.
John, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what Blue Run Ventures does?
So Blue Run Ventures is an early stage venture fund. We've been around for 20 years. We have invested in a wide range of technology companies, always early stage. And we generally focus on IT with a focus more on financial services. And now more and more we're doing a wide range of SaaS products and health tech. And we've had some success in consumer services over the years as well. So we are pretty omnivorous when it comes to looking at great teams with great ideas. We found we've had most of our success actually in the financial services space. And so I think it may be worth digging more into that as we go through the conversation.
Yeah, sure. So you guys have been around for a while. What do you think that it is that's helped Blue Run Ventures survive through the dot-com bust and the financial crisis and everything else?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's a fair amount of luck, I think, for anyone being around 20 years in this business.
It's nice to hear an honest answer. We're just lucky.
There's some luck and there's some skill. So, we've actually, going back to the beginning of the fund, right before the dot-com bust, we were fortunate enough to lead the Series A in a company that became PayPal, which we were in Confinity, which had a product called PayPal, which we led the Series A round with Max Lefchin and Peter Thiel and Luke Nosek. And so that was really a nice way to get started on our run. That company, of course, went public and was sold to eBay before the meltdown. But since then, we've actually used some of the economic cycles actually to our advantage in our investing, and not the typical sort of catchphrases around it's always good to invest in a down market and great companies are made during recessions. I mean, there's some truth to that, but we're looking more at the trends that are taking place during the downturns. And so probably the most clear case study for that is a company called Cabbage, which we invested in right after the global financial crisis in 08. Which was the businesses was just premised on helping small businesses get access to working capital.
Yeah. So that's one of your more recent big hits.
It is. It's still at the plate though. It's not exited yet. We're still in the game there. But yes, the company's performed very well. And to your point, I think some of our staying power has been really around trying to see what the trends are, whether they're good or bad, and then find opportunities to invest in those.
I wonder, what do you look for in a company that you want to invest in? And also, what kind of trends do you see taking place in the fintech ecosystem?
The first one is really, I think, an interesting one, really, in terms of what we're looking for in founding teams. And that really sort of transcends industries and market cycles. And that's really just finding a founder, ideally a founding team, that is really truly inspirational for us, and they need to inspire us. They have to inspire their customers. They have to inspire their employees, and that's just not something that comes naturally to someone who just has a good idea. I mean, it is true that the good ideas are a dime a dozen, but its execution is what really sets it apart. And you can't execute without good people around you. So that's really what we look for, is like, hey, does this person, or does this team of founders have the ability to attract the best talent to them? Oftentimes, when we're first investing in a Series A or even a seed company, you're at a point where the people who are working on that team are the only people who you can get to work for you. and then you shift later in the company's life into getting the actual key leaders that you want to be working for you. And so it's important that when we add the catalyst of our capital and hopefully some of our experience from the venture dollars coming in, we're able to move to that second category where we're getting the people that we really want to grow the company. And that's incumbent upon having a strong leader. So that's mm-hmm. that's a lot of fun. That's a lot of what this business is. It's really finding the right people. I was surprised when I got into the business, because I thought it was much more of a financial job, but it's really very much of a human capital job.
Yeah. How much of what skill sets do you think have to come with the person already to you? And what do you think you can teach them or help them develop into? I know a lot of people don't come in with, CEO skills or advanced management of people in complex system skills. But some of those can be taught, and some things have to be with the person. How do you see that breaking up?
Yeah. No, you're right. Many times the CEOs of these companies are managing the largest company they've ever been a part of. So they're absolutely mm-hmm. learning in real time. I think that is some of the value that I think not just investors, but the outside board members and advisors and folks can bring. So what you really look for is this founding team who has this really unique mix of being very strong minded and clear purposed, but also open to suggestion. You're like, hey, this is my idea, but hey, maybe there's another way I can do it. So trying to find that balance without seeming like you're just, blowing in the wind to any good idea that comes along. It's really a fine balance there. And I don't know how much of that kind of intuition can be taught, but certainly there's, in terms of some of the more, blocking and tackling, running, scaling an organization, putting together compensation plans and those kind of things, those can be taught, of course. But it's really you have to have the right temperament to be able to listen to advice and not take it personally, but internalize what's good and be able to separate what isn't. So it's that's really the magic of the business is finding these guys and gals who can walk that line.
Can you share some of the companies in your portfolio now that you're really excited about?
Absolutely, happy to. Luckily, a lot of them are really in the financial services space, which is, mm-hmm. I think, an area that is really ripe for disruption. You talked about the different economic cycles, and when I came into this job, I came out of the communication space, and I thought that was really all the innovation was going to be. And it turned out the networks were already all built, and so there was no more innovation to be happening in the network level, and so it moved to the application layer. And so, mm-hmm. similarly, in the financial services space, we're moving into this space now where the consumers and small businesses are more attuned to other abilities, other ways to use their money. I mean, it all started really with a lot of the deregulation in the 70s with these companies being able to effectively decouple the lending from the depositing and really driving higher yields and better cash management has become more of a necessary requirement to run a successful business. So what we're really seeing is that small businesses are becoming much more acutely aware of the cost of capital in terms of understanding needs of working capital, understanding how they need to put their money to work, whether it's better deposits or better understanding their accounts payable pipeline, things like that. And those are all areas which are not necessarily key to building a good product, running a good business, but they are across industries. You have to have that ability. So we've been investing in that field. So specifically, we're in a company called Cabbage, which makes small business loans. And initially, they started making loans to businesses who were selling online, so eBay merchants and Amazon merchants, who didn't really have a clear balance sheet or inventory they could show to a bank and say, hey. Because oftentimes they're running the business out of their garage, and traditional lenders did not know how to bank these kinds of companies. So Cabbage used real-time data, looked at other signals other than the traditional signals that a bank would be looking at to make to make lending decisions. And it's really, really blossomed. The company is now doing $10 million of originations every single day. And it's crazy how much capacity there is for for borrowing.
So an untapped market, a clear pain point for the small and medium-sized business.
Absolutely. And what you don't realize is not having access to capital, it's not just an inconvenience. It really slows down your growth. You can't hire the extra people. You can't buy if you see inventory that is available at a discounted price, you can't buy it because you don't have enough cash. So it's not simply so what we really try to do is be a business partner for them versus just another bill they have to pay. Here's my term loan I need to service. We try to be a bit more proactive and look at sort of be an outsourced CFO for small businesses, because it's really not those folks' strong suit. You know, they're better at the creation side of the business. If they're a baker or whatever the business happens to be, that's their skill set. So we try to automate and take away the pain around cash management.
We see Square jumping into this, Prosper, a lot of players.
Yeah, Square's doing a great job.
I'll let you do the sales pitch. What does Kabbage do differently from their competitors?
Thank you. Yes. So what they focus on is using real-time data to make lending decisions immediately. So as fast as you can type in your credentials and let us know your power ranking on eBay, or how much, what your bank balance looks like in a particular account, how many different transactions you're doing in a month. We make real-time assessments and push money to your account in real time. So, and really just a few minutes, 3, 4, 5 minutes, you're able to have cash in your account. And I think that's really a major competitive advantage. Understanding that companies are not in the business of trying to spend all their free time optimizing around better ways to get loans or deposits or meet payroll. So we're just there. It's a very simple solution. So that's really the key to the company's success, is that we are there when the small business needs us. Square has a great product too. I mean, Square tends to be a bit more focused more on the retail side. They have a real nice product to get repayments directly from cash receipts, which is an interesting way to do it. Ours is a little bit more flexible on the payment methods, but so that's part of it. And then it's really the second part is really being more predictive. So we can tell if you're making payroll every 2 weeks, you have payroll, and we can see what your balances are looking like. We can come to you in advance, and we do this and say, hey, it looks like you may be needing some cash in the next 5 days to make sure you don't have a shortfall in payroll. Would you like to borrow $1,500? And simply click a button, yes or no, and you have the money in your account. So we try to become more of a partner with the small business versus just being another bill they have to pay.
So this is where we are now with SMB lending. What do you think this develops into in the next few years, two to five years, let's say?
Well, I think it will, ideally, it will develop into something which is almost invisible to the businesses, and that they have such a seamless interaction with their money that it will really effectively be run automatically for them. And that's really where we want to go. There are other areas of pain as well, particularly around accounts receivable. I mean, if you can't, and we talked about working capital briefly. So we run another company called PayStamp. And what they do is they make it easier for businesses to literally just collect the money from their customers, who they often are doing business with routinely. Like, they have a monthly invoice or sometimes weekly invoices with the customers. This company tries to automate effectively. It's like a Venmo for B2B payments. So imagine not having to go through writing a PO and cutting a check and getting the check signed and putting it in the mail. All that, that's crazy. That still happens for the majority of invoices that are paid in the business world.
I thought companies did that so they wouldn't have to pay so timely. They could just stretch out their payables.
That is true, but
that might be the incentive for the vendor, but not for the company paying it.
Well, you're right, but there's generally it's not a pure relationship. Usually, one, either the buyer or the seller has a bit more leverage in the transaction and the relationship, and so we focus on those where we know that the supplier definitely has some advantage and say, look, we know you need our product. We are going to ask you to pay on a more timely basis, and we're making it easier for you. We'll do it electronically. So you make a good point. There's definitely cash flow conservation requirements on the part of the payer, but the idea is that if everyone is using payment acceleration, then everyone, so you know, their customer will get capital more quickly too.
Sure. I'm only half kidding.
No, you're right. Well, it's very much of a it's like in your economics 101. It's like, you know, your M1 and your M2 and the whole money supply system, right? The faster you can get turnovers on dollars, the faster the economy grows. And that's really what we're talking about here, is we're just increasing the velocity of the capital through the system, which is, I think, good for everyone. I totally get your point on a micro level. That's absolutely true. But on a macro level, I can have profound implications on the growth of the economy.
Jonathan, listening to you talk about cabbage and pay stamp, particularly pay stamp, sounds like almost a recession-proof business, right? Because businesses still keep doing business with one another. But, you know, cabbage started right before the global financial crisis, and we have had a really nice long run of the economy. What are some of the things that some of the companies that you work with, what are some of the ways that they're thinking about, how does my business model need to shift when we're in a different economic cycle?
Yeah, that's a good question, and your point's well taken with regard to the expansion that we've gone through, and Cabbage really has been a beneficiary of that, as well as all their customers. One thing we do with them in particular is our average loan is actually a very short duration. It's generally 6 months, sometimes 12 months long. So if your average is a 6 month loan, of course, the average time that it's outstanding is on average about 3 months or so. So the overall portfolio is relatively short term in duration, so we can have a pretty good sense for what the collections rates will look like. But speaking more broadly than just Cabbage, we are looking at other ways for companies to really manage cash more wisely. There are, of course, I live and work in Silicon Valley. There are certain roles that when you're hiring new positions can be done almost or as effectively in other parts of the country, even other parts of the world. It's just, it just makes sense for us. Really, oftentimes these kinds of decisions are put off until belt tightening really is mandatory. So we're trying to get ahead of that right now with some of our portfolio companies, saying, hey, let's mm-hmm. let's make those hard changes now. When we're looking to add that next call center person, whatever happens to be, let's put that person in a place that they can feel very much feel like they're part of the team, but in an area that maybe is a little less expensive for the company. So mm-hmm. we don't have to worry about having, it would be a shame to simply lay folks off just because they're living or working in an area that's a high rent district, so to speak.
So it sounds like Cabbage, I think, is headquartered in Georgia, and I see the Payson looks to be near Santa Cruz. Is that something it's shifting the way in which you guys invest? Is that sort of that shift away from the core Bay Area companies?
It is. It's due to a couple different things. Yeah, but our last few investments, Paystance in Santa Cruz, we just invested in a company outside of Los Angeles. My most mm-hmm. recent deal was a company based in Mexico City, which is a completely different cost structure. We have always, as a firm, looked outside the Bay Area for innovation. Silicon Valley definitely has a very strong grip on financing and venture capital, but the ideas tend to be a bit more evenly distributed. So we've always been happy to get on a plane, and we have companies in San Diego and Boulder and New York, Vancouver. We're really pretty widely distributed. We have companies in Ireland. We've invested in Israel. We know that we're a small fund. Our fund's generally around $150 million, and we're relatively small versus some of our peers who are also investing in Series A's. And so we need to be a little bit more creative. We need to sometimes go a little bit further from home, maybe take on a little bit more risk, geographical risk. Sometimes we go in a little bit earlier to make sure we're able to get access to the deals, because we're not going to be able to get there just by having the biggest checkbook.
Is that part of the effect from like large funds like the SoftBank Vision Fund and Andreessen coming up, and maybe do you see the valuations getting driven up by those sort of players?
Well, that's a good question. Those are really two pretty different funds. SoftBank, I'd have to say no. We've had really very good relations working with them. They're sort of like a supersized early stage investor. They're very, very pro founder, very pro growth, looking to make game changing bets. And we don't compete with them, given that they are later stage investors. Andreessen is also another excellent fund. They compete they're multi stage, and so we do have to. If we're going to be, quote competing, it's never really quite as clear as like a head-to-head competition. But to the extent we're looking at similar deals, we need to be a little more creative, maybe going a little bit earlier than we would be comfortable doing otherwise. But SoftBank is they're a force to be reckoned with. It's as I said, we're a small fund, and I know that I'm not going to change the world or change what they're doing. So I'm happy to be able to work with them. We've had a lot of success. And in fact, they're investors in Cabbage, and we're happy to have them in there.
That's right. You've already changed the world, Jonathan. Don't worry.
Well, I don't know if we have, but hopefully some of our companies hopefully have.
So let's talk about the hyped buzzword kind of things, and if they have any impact. So blockchain, we see a lot of proof of concept kind of things. And one thing that I noticed is that there's not a lot of products or production or even on the back end where a lot of people are working to develop things. Does that mean it's just too early to invest in blockchain? It still has some years to build up all the parts it needs?
I think it's probably just starting to happen now. The thing that's interesting about blockchain, it really is sort of infrastructure. It's like saying I'm investing in internet. It's not that's not a core value proposition around which to build a company. It's like saying my company is mobile, and it's not really. We have companies, Paystan in specific, Paystan uses blockchain, but we don't lead with that when we're selling customers. We're investors in a company called Waze, the navigation system you may be familiar with. So we sold Waze to Google a few years ago. So Waze is doing simultaneous transactions with millions of drivers in real time. Now, if that had to go through blockchain, that service would never work, because the amount of computational power that Waze uses is just so immense, and blockchain is just not set up for that. In some respects, blockchain is the technology looking for a solution. In other ways, it's fine as a ledger, and people should be able to keep track of the provenance of where their money came from, things like that. But for the most part, U.S. currency and so forth works just fine. So we're not focused on it. We see a lot of smart folks working on blockchain solutions, but it's not something that is, like I said earlier, it's not a fundamental reason to invest in a company.
There's a lot of talk now, where I'd argue that we're in the middle of a tech clash because of all the data breaches and all that stuff. And I wonder, is that any concern for the companies that you invest in? Or because it seems like you're focusing more on the SMB or SME space, that's not something that you really have to consider when you look at a company.
When we talked about big buzzwords, I thought that privacy was going to be one of the ones that was brought up right after blockchain. And so you're right. You're right on point in that we focus more on SMBs, but I mean, make no mistake, they have Know Your Customer, we have Know Your Business, KYB. Mm-hmm. There's definitely, we have to be careful around anti-money laundering rules and things like that. Privacy is very much as important in the SMB side, but I think what you're seeing on the SMB side versus the consumer side is that businesses understand that by giving up data, there's a more clear value exchange. I think it's a little harder to see if I'm using Gmail for free and I'm getting advertisements, that's a value exchange there. But with SMBs, if I'm giving you information about my bank histories and my credit card balances, and then I'm able to get a loan from that, it's a very short walk from A to B to say, oh, I share some of my personal information or my company's information, and I get value. It's very much hand in glove kind of relationship. It's much more attenuated on the consumer side. So I think that's part of the consternation that the regulators are having, is that they can't clearly tie the value to the information being exchanged.
Yeah, and you have less parties to that transaction, right? In the business example, you've got kind of a customer who's paying for a service and receiving the service. It's not necessarily the case when you get those ads from Gmail. You've got that advertiser in there.
Yes, the consumer is effectively a sort of necessary grist to make the mill grind, right? If you don't have the users, then you're not going to have anything there to which to monetize. So you're right about that. It is different on the consumer side.
And I have to say, there's nothing more romantic than being a customer who's a necessary grist. That's very quotable, Jonathan.
I think we just found our tagline.
Oh, man. That's what I'll be known for.
Don't worry.
Great.
You just stepped into like my personal, the place where I'm like the most interested in what's going on with technology. So you can't help that.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, you can appreciate the value of something like a business like Waze then, when we have millions of people reporting into Google, you know, the bad, big bad Google, where their car is at all times. But people love it.
And when people love it, when people love it and they understand the terms under which they're engaging in the transaction, that's all fine. And of course, this is certainly not something that you or your firms have done, but I think it was just yesterday was in the news that Facebook had been basically
using the phone
getting
numbers.
People's phone numbers,
yeah,
getting their phone numbers for their two-factor authentication, and then using it as a way to target advertising. Like, oh God, come on. Like, informed disclosure should count. And I think that for a lot of the companies that you have a history of investing in, that ethos is probably pretty well understood in the milieus that those companies are working in, right? Small companies don't want their private credit data or cash flow data out there to entities that they don't want them to get it to, right? So I'm imagining that it's quite different for kind of this business-to-business world.
You're right. Now I think you're clearly a student of the subject, and that's exactly right. There's a different level of understanding and really different levels of data collection as well. I mean, personal data from a business is just not as, it's not as sensitive just on the face of it.
Right.
If you need a privacy consultant, Monica is available for reasonable rates.
Excellent.
But listen, the problem is I give all my opinions away for free. I don't even give anyone a chance to pay me.
Right. Yeah, that subject's not going to be going away. It's going to be, I tend to think that maybe the pendulum has swung a bit too far to one side. I think that it's certainly good to shine a light on these practices. And the one you mentioned, you know, if that's in fact the way that goes down, was, I think, certainly, you know, beyond what anyone's expectations would have been for their phone number. But I think that I think if something comes out of this, whether it's the data dividend that Governor Newsom is talking about or something else, but if there's more transparency about how data is being used, if that comes out of this, I think that will that'll be an important outcome of this current outcry.
All right. That's a great place to end it, Monica. Thanks.
Right.
And again, that was Jonathan Ebinger, general partner at Blue Run Ventures, investors in Cabbage, Paystand, and an early investor in PayPal. Please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com for any questions, comments, or if there's a topic you'd like us to cover. Hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thanks for listening.